And so that's the way I prefer to look at the passing of 9 years. But in Syria, I couldn't look the way I wanted to at the passing of 9 years, as I passed the streets, alleyways, and buildings. I could only keep myself composed to some extent, as opposed to many others who were in shock and awe when they encountered these scenes. Especially when I saw all of those factories and workshops that used to be full of workers, engineers, and technicians 9 years ago. People who are no longer in their workplaces. Many people who are no longer with us. There's not enough space in the ground to hide their bodies. Sometimes a park in the street becomes their burial place. I felt that in Syria, I didn't have the right to speak of anything other than the war for the past 9 years. However, I decided to at least look for answers to why all of this happened in Syria. Why Syria? In the United States, people are not very political. Therefore, it really doesn't matter to them what happens in the rest of the world.
CBS News came to this place called Attaf with General Frank McKenzie, commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East.
David, we're standing on the Damascus-Baghdad highway, just inside Syria, and what we're doing here is supporting our partners in the fight against ISIS.
However, not all the people here are American. Some members of Syria's opposition visit the TANF base regularly. Apart from their looks and uniforms, they can be recognized by their Arabic language and their Toyota vans. It appears they are opposed to the Syrian government and have come together to fight the Syrian army. But it appears that their main mission after protecting the American base is controlling the roads that pass through TANF. Of course, the Chinese, in cooperation with many other Asian countries, like Iran, intend to revive the Silk Road. This is a decision which is not secret, as they have talked about it openly on many occasions. Till then, the road linking Baghdad to Damascus, and from there to the Mediterranean coast, is still considered as the Silk Road. Wesley Clark is not the only person who believes the war in Syria was planned long before it started. Many others, like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., also share this belief. He is the nephew of the former President of the United States. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is both a lawyer and author, published an article in 2016 in Politico magazine entitled "Why Arabs Don't Want Us in Syria." The article stunned many. He writes, "In their view, our war against Bashar Assad did not begin with the peaceful civil protests of the Arab Spring in 2011. In their view, our war against Bashar Assad did not begin with the peaceful civil protests of the Arab Spring in 2011. Instead, it began in 2000, when Qatar proposed to construct a $10 billion, 1,500-kilometer pipeline through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Turkey. To see whether Kennedy's claims are true or false, we go back to the year 2000. As you are aware, Russia is the biggest producer and exporter of natural gas, with Europe being its biggest customer. The Russians export 70% of their produced natural gas to Europe. The US is highly motivated as it tries to find an alternative to Russia's gas. As a result, they have turned to Qatar and Azerbaijan for gas. But the fact is that Europe's demand for gas could not be met via sea only, and that such a huge supply could only be sent to the continent through a pipeline. This was where the notion of the Qatari gas pipeline was put forth. That's the same energy transit route that would pass through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Syria, and then reach Europe via Turkish terminals. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. writes, "In Putin's view, the Qatar pipeline is a NATO plot to change the status quo, deprive Russia of its only foothold in the Middle East, strangle the Russian economy, and end Russian leverage in the European energy market." This plan faced a big obstacle, the Syrian government. Elsewhere in his article, Kennedy writes, "In 2009, Syrians announced that they would refuse to sign the agreement to allow the pipeline to run through Syria to protect the interests of their Russian allies. They also announced commissioning of Russian-approved Islamic pipeline with cooperation from Iran and Iraq. This Islamic pipeline would transport Iran's gas to the Mediterranean through Iraq and Syria, with its final destination being West and Southwestern Europe. The project would become a huge source of revenue for Syria and Iraq, as well as Iran." As a result, all the three countries insisted on its execution. Now, there were problems. On the one hand, Qatar's gas could not be transferred via Syria. On the other hand, Iran would gain a foothold in the European energy market. That's why they decided to remove the problem, namely the Syrian government.
This morning, President Obama called on Assad to step aside and announced the strongest set of sanctions to date targeting the Syrian government. These sanctions include the energy sector to increase pressure on the regime. The transition to democracy in Syria has begun, and it's time for Assad to get out of the way. As President Obama said this morning, no outside power can or should impose on this transition.
Cables released by the whistleblower organization WikiLeaks show that the Israeli, Saudi, and U.S. intelligence agencies started to give financial and intelligence assistance to the groups seeking to topple the Syrian government. This dates back to 2 years before the onset of protests in Syria. Regardless of the WikiLeaks cables, the most optimistic interpretation is that the 2011 protests over economic and political problems in Syria provided an opportunity to implement the Qatar gas pipeline to the Mediterranean by toppling the Assad government. Thus, the protests in Syria soon turned into a full-blown armed conflict, unlike Bahrain and Tunisia, where demonstrations remained peaceful. In a 2016 interview with an Italian news outlet, Bashar Assad explained the issue of the pipeline and the unfolding of the crisis in this way.
Many political analysts think the Syrian no to the pipeline routes proposed by Qatar may be one of the reasons why the war had begun in 2011. How important has been your no to Qatar in the beginning of the war?
It is one of the important factors, but it wasn't offered to us publicly. But I think it was planned. There was two routes crossing Syria. One of them is north-south, which is related to Qatar, as you just mentioned. And the other one was east-west to the Mediterranean that crossed Iraq from Iran. And I don't think many countries who opposed the policy of Syria didn't want Syria to be a hub of power, of energy, whether electricity or oil, or even crossroads of railways and so on.
Later, in an interview with Russia Today, the WikiLeaks founder showed a cable that revealed Saudi Arabia and Qatar were providing military assistance to anti-government armed groups and even ISIS in Syria.
Early 2014 email from Hillary Clinton, so not so long after she left Secretary of State, to her campaign manager, John Podesta. That email, it states that ISIS, is funded by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, the governments of Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Now, I think this is the most significant email in the whole collection, and perhaps because Saudi and Qatari money is spread all over the place, including into many media institutions. Under Hillary Clinton, and our Clinton emails reveal significant discussion about it, the largest ever arms deal in the world was made with Saudi Arabia, more than $80 billion.
And of course, the consequence of that is that this notorious terrorist group called ISIL or ISIS is created largely with money from the very people who are giving money to the Clinton Foundation.
It's a belief, but thanks to Trump, we can believe much of these stuff. Do you remember when Donald Trump described ISIS as a creation of Obama and Clinton during his 2016 presidential campaign?
He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. Okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be Crooked Hillary Clinton. Co-founder, Crooked Hillary Clinton.
Another person who can easily answer these questions is Qatar's former Prime Minister, Hamad bin Jassim.
There's even questions that have been raised about how much funding Qatar has done to some of the Islamic groups in Syria.
Look, in Syria, everybody did mistakes, including your country. When the war or the revolution happened in Syria, all of us worked through two operation rooms, one in Jordan and one in Turkey. The first one was in Jordan, and there was countries, some of the GCC countries, among them the Saudis, the Emiratis, Qatar, United States, and other ally. And there was working from there. And all of us, we were supporting the same group. In Turkey, we did the same. We discovered by the time, you supported wrong groups sometimes, sure, but you stop. It doesn't mean that we did not do something wrong there.
Whichever way you look at this story, the support of Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey of armed opposition forces in Syria is unequivocal. We should remember that in the U.S. gas project, the Turks and the Saudis would also receive hefty transit duties for allowing the pipeline pass through their territories. The Qataris themselves have admitted this. When relations between Qatar and Saudi Arabia soured, and the Saudis put Qatar under economic and political pressure, Qatari officials tried to place the blame for what happened in Syria on Riyadh. They were not aware that they were admitting to their role in the Syria crisis, too.
And at the beginning, and I say this publicly, the beginning, we have the green light from King Abdullah, late King Abdullah, that we lead and they will support us in this. And that was a discussion direct with Abdullah. And then they tried to, later they want to change their opinion. They should inform us. We don't mind to be in the back seat and they
wanted
the
to
lead.
Take the lead?
Yeah, we don't mind they take the lead. They are the biggest, big country. We choose to be there because they don't want to appear in the beginning that they are, you know, completely involved. It was easy to change the regime first year.
Easy,
because there was no Russian completely involvement, no Iranian involvement.
There were accusations that Qatar funded al-Nusra, which was linked to al-Qaeda. This happened, yes.
I don't think we have a relation with somebody which United States and all the other allies does not know about it.
In the midst of all this, leaders of some terrorist groups would make statements that would serve as a clue for smart people. Like this one. One of the most prominent propaganda leaders of Jabhat al-Nusra, who was critical of Saudi Arabia for sanctioning Qatar, believes the Qataris were among the biggest supporters of the Syrian opposition from the beginning. The city of the Silk Road and Qatar's pipeline project are not the only reasons for the war on Syria. Just look for US military bases in Syria other than Tanf. From the onset of the war in Syria, all US military bases other than Tanf were established in the country's north and northeast. At the time, the US set up the bases under the pretext of helping Syrian Kurds in the face of attacks by terrorist groups, especially ISIS. The Kurds were content with the US military bases and rejected help from the Syrian army. But in 2019, Trump suddenly announced he was withdrawing US forces from Syria. However, it was later revealed that the United States was not only planning to pull out their troops, but intended to beef up their military presence in places like Tanf.
But we are leaving soldiers to secure the oil. Now, we may have to fight for the oil. That's okay. Maybe somebody else wants the oil, in which case they have a hell of a fight. But there's massive amounts of oil, and we're securing it for a couple of reasons. Number one, it stops ISIS, because ISIS got tremendous wealth from that oil. We have taken it. It's secured. Number two, and again, somebody else may claim it, but either we'll negotiate a deal with whoever's claiming it, if we think it's fair, or we will militarily stop them very quickly. We have tremendous power in that part of the world. We have, the airport is right nearby, a very big, very monstrous, very powerful airport and very expensive airport that was built years ago. We're in that Middle East now for $8 trillion. So we don't want to be...
Let's take a look at this map. Nearly all U.S. military bases are close to Syria's oil-rich areas. Trump justifies the U.S. encircling and extortion of these oil wells by claiming that the United States spent $8 trillion. During his presidency, Trump has frequently vowed to pull out U.S. forces from the Middle East, most particularly Syria. But in the same period, the U.S. has built 6 new bases in northeast Syria.
Yeah. And one of the things that was brought out by the media, actually, and wisely and correctly brought out, we have very few boats going there anymore because we have our own oil and gas. We don't need it from the Middle East anymore. And that's why we're pursuing a future not only of energy independence, but not just words. You know, you've been hearing energy independence for years and years, and you'd hear it. We have real independence. But what we want now is not independence. We want American energy dominance. Dominance.
All this constitutes only part of the economic motive for Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the United States to wage a war on Syria. Now the key question is, in light of all the proof, should we keep on thinking that the war in Syria is nothing but an ethno-religious conflict? What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Limelight. Germany is expecting its worst economic crisis in 70 years. In a report by Der Spiegel news magazine published recently, high inflation, rising energy prices, and a slowing economy are counted as Germany's recent crises have worsened after Russia began a special military operation in Ukraine in February. Latest surveys show that Germans are deeply worried about the energy crisis and rising inflation more than the crisis in Ukraine. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world press and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned, please. Financial Times Daily wrote, German inflation soared to double-digit levels for the first time in more than 70 years, underlining the precarious state of Europe's largest economy, which leading economists warned could shrink by up to 7.9% next year in a worst-case scenario. Chancellor Olaf Scholz responded to soaring energy costs on Thursday, September 29th, by announcing plans for a 200 billion euros cap on gas prices, which he described as a defensive shield to be financed by extending an off-balance sheet fund set up to provide aid during the coronavirus pandemic. According to a flash estimate published by the Federal Statistical Energy on Thursday, consumer prices in Germany rose 10.9% in the year to September, accelerating from 8.8% in August. It is the first time German inflation has reached double-digit levels since 1951, and the increase is expected to lift overall Eurozone inflation to a new record of 9.7% when those figures were released on Friday, September 30. Carsten Brzezinski, an economist at Deutsche Bank ING, said inflation is running red hot in Germany, adding that it was hard to see how the European Central Bank could not raise interest rates by 75 percentage points for a third consecutive time at next month's meeting. The increase in German prices, which rose 2.2% month-on-month, was driven by the expiry of temporary measures to shield households and businesses from the impact of high prices, such as a fuel duty cut and a subsidized 9 euros monthly train ticket. Energy prices rose 43.9% in the year to September, accelerating from 35.6% growth in August, while food prices surged 18.7% against 16.6% a month earlier. Services price growth accelerated to 3.6% from 2.2%. Russia's decision to cut gas supplies to Europe after its military operation in Ukraine has plunged Germany into its worst energy crisis since the Second World War. Soaring gas prices have forced many companies to reduce production or even shut down entirely, while private households are preparing for a huge increase in heating bills. Anadolu News Agency explains more about the story, saying more and more Germans are seeking help from food banks and charities due to record high inflation and soaring energy bills. According to the Federal Food Bank umbrella organization TAFL Deutschland, demand has increased compared to the previous year, with more than 2 million people now relying on food donations, visiting food banks and local charities. Heik Bench, a 41-year-old mother of five children, is among those receiving help from a local charity in Berlin. Bench said that although she has a job, she's struggling to pay the bills. She told Anadolu News Agency, "I work as a cleaner for 4 hours a day, but it's hard to make ends meet because everything is getting more expensive. You can see it in the food prices." The current energy crisis in Germany and skyrocketing bills have made life more difficult for lower-income households. Russian special operation in Ukraine, consequent Western sanctions against Kremlin, and growing tensions between European countries and Moscow have pushed energy prices higher. According to estimates, households will have to pay around 3,500 euros for gas this winter, nearly three times what they paid last year. Bench expressed frustration with the German coalition government for not taking serious measures to support lower-income households in the country. A recent study by polling firm CV showed that the energy crisis is currently the number one concern of Germans, polling at 68%, followed by inflation at 64% and the war at 55%. Germany's top economic institute said the country would expand by 1.4% this year, contract by 0.4% in 2023, and grow by 1.9% in 2024. But they also warned the economy could shrink by 7.9% next year in the event of an unusually cold winter and the introduction of gas rationing in industry. The institute said that based on the median of their model simulations, Germany will not run out of gas this year and next, though the supply situation would remain extremely tight. They said that this will mean a permanent loss of prosperity for Germany. According to top news magazine Der Spiegel's recent report, German families with two children and a net income of 3,000 euros per month are worried about social justice in the country, as citizens must pay 1,000 euros more a month for gas and electricity and purchase prices of 1 million euros for a two-bedroom apartment. The report revealed that during the second quarter of this year, real wages fell by 4.4%. The Spark 7 brand savings bank association estimates that 60% of households in Germany soon will no longer be able to put money aside. In recent weeks, thousands have taken to the streets in protest in the cities of Leipzig, Magdeburg, and Pforzheim, and it's possible this is only the beginning. Politicians are warning of the possibility of a hot autumn, some of a winter of rage, referring to possible protest and unrest. Also, protesters marched on Saturday, October 1st, against soaring inflation and rising cost of living in Western Germany. Gathering in the city center of Cologne, hundreds of protesters chanted, "Enough is enough, prices have to fall." Protesting against rising inflation, especially in energy prices, demonstrators called on the authorities to tackle to this issue and take measure. Protesters emphasized that tens of thousands of people were driven into poverty due to rising prices, and that many could not pay their gas and electricity bills, while many opportunists, especially energy companies, are taking advantage of this situation.
Hidden files.
But Cece never saw her husband's face again because her plane crashed that morning at 10:03. What took place on 9/11 was the deadliest attack on U.S. soil ever, which took the lives of almost 3,000 people. People whom some of their heartbreaking stories have been told and retold over and over again by mainstream media. But the greatest toll this incident took was neither on September the 11th nor in America. And that's where millions more heartbreaking stories are waiting to be heard. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzieh Hashemi, and today I'm here to share with you stories of the fall of people who had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks. People who fell victim to the campaign that started following September 11th, a campaign named the War on Terror. Following the September 11th attacks, U.S. President George W. Bush declared a global military war on terror campaign. He called on world leaders to join the U.S. in this fight and said, "Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or with the terrorists." Bush then stated how this war on terror was to unfold. "Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated." Well, let's look at how a lot of these events unfolded. October the 7th, 2001, airstrikes were launched in Afghanistan by the U.S., and the UK, followed by a ground offensive. And more than 240,000 Afghans were killed as a direct result. And then if we go forward to March the 19th, 2003, US and coalition forces invaded Iraq, claiming that the country had weapons of mass destruction. More than 300,000 Iraqis were killed as a direct result. Today, the War on Terror campaign continues to be used as an excuse for bombing people from Afghanistan to Yemen. According to the Cost of War Project, by 2021, over 900,000 people had been killed in the War on Terror, and over 80 countries are currently being targeted by the War on Terror today. But was this war on terror campaign a sudden decision in the aftermath of 9/11? Or were the attacks used as an excuse to justify a full-fledged pre-planned war? Well, our first guest, Scott Ritter, who is a whistleblower and former intelligence officer, is here with us to discuss more.
Scott Ritter, United States Marine Corps intelligence officer, who was a chief weapons inspector with the UN in Iraq from 1991 to 1998. Mr. Ritter quit the inspections team in 1998. He became a whistleblower and a critic of the Bush administration's claims that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
Thanks so much for being with us, Scott, here on Hidden Files. I mean, can you explain your perspective exactly what the concept of war on terror means?
We were attacked on 9/11. Now, we can have a discussion about whether or not this was blowback from, you know, decades of American malpractice and malfeasance in the Middle East. That's a fair point. But we did not invite this attack. We did not want this attack. We did not will this attack. We were attacked. And, you know, the world saw that and recognized that. That's why the world rallied behind the United States in the aftermath of 9/11, saying this was unwarranted, this was unjust, this was horrible, and we will support the United States. But they weren't willing to support the United States in carrying out a counteroffensive that went beyond simply punishing those who perpetrated the attack. And that's what the war on terror became. It wasn't about punishing Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. It was about American asserting dominance on an entire region, and indeed, by doing so, on the entire world. And that's what the war on terror was. It wasn't a war on terror. It was basically a war of regional and global domination by the United States using a horrible act of terrorism as justification.
Well, don't you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq even prior to the September 11th attacks?
I think the Department of Defense had been heavily engaged with Iraq over the decade of the 90s, and that there were military contingencies in place that could have the United States defeating Iraq, occupying Iraq. These were plans. They weren't necessarily fully developed. The CIA would play a supporting role in that, but there is ample evidence that the United States had plans in the works for invading and occupying Iraq prior to 9/11.
Well, what are some of the lingering effects of the U.S. war on Iraq?
The war in Iraq has never ended. I mean, it continues to this day. The political instability that we see in Baghdad is a direct consequence of the decision by the United States to invade and occupy Iraq in 2003.
Well, do you think that the U.S. would have invaded Iraq even if the 9/11 attacks hadn't taken place, since Iraq really had nothing to do with those attacks anyway?
I think the events of 9/11 accelerated the inevitable military conflict between the United States and Iraq that had been brewing for over a decade since the end of Operation Desert Storm in 1991. The Clinton administration in 1998 had put in place a law that basically codified regime change as the official policy of the United States government. And the United States was moving toward a decisive confrontation with Iraq that would have occurred whether or not 9/11, you know, took place. I think 9/11 accelerated this, but the American public was already pre-programmed to accept the notion that Saddam Hussein was an evil that needed to be confronted and destroyed. And they were unquestioning about the weapons of mass destruction narrative that was being put forward by the United States government well before 9/11.
Well, in your perspective, who benefited from the war?
I mean, the short-term benefit was getting rid of Saddam Hussein, who had proven to be a perpetual thorn in the side of multiple American presidential administrations. His continued survival was an embarrassment to the United States. But beyond that, the United States gained no benefit. This was a colossal failure. It was a failure from almost day one. We never won over the Iraqi people. We were always seen as an occupying force. And that notion of the American occupier flew in the face of what we were trying to promote, which is the role of the United States as a liberator, promulgating the model of American democracy as something that should be emulated regionally. Instead, we became the brutal occupier, and we turned the region and indeed much of the world against us. There's nothing positive that came out of America's precipitous invasion and occupation of Iraq.
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Scott Ritter. Now, the war on terror was not limited to bombing locations claimed to be terrorist hotspots in different countries. It entailed control of countries and their resources. One example of such control was when Paul Bremer, an American diplomat, was deployed to Iraq, where he became the country's chief executive authority following the U.S.'s invasion. Now, he wanted to implement 100 different orders in Iraq through one of Bremer's orders. The Iraqi army was dismantled, also using Coalition Provisional Authority, CPA. Bremer changed the Iraqi constitution to benefit American authorities. For instance, CPA's draft included banning political parties opposed to the U.S.'s occupation from participating in elections. And so from the U.S. controlling any government that would come to be in Iraq to the country even losing autonomy over its seed bank for farming, every aspect of life in Iraq was affected. Neoliberalism was being infused throughout the country, and it wasn't the Iraqi people who were profiting. There was a major heist during the occupation on so many levels, from cultural artifacts being stolen to the national wealth of the country's oil being completely controlled by the U.S. to the billions of dollars that Western contractors won. Now, let's take a look at some of these contractors.
The number of contractors on the ground outnumbered U.S. troops most years of the U.S. occupation. American politicians were invested in the contractors. Many of them owned stocks in these contractors' companies. U.S. politicians had personal interests and stocks in these contractors. 51 congressmen and women, along with their spouses, owned between $2.3 and $5.8 million worth of stocks in the top 30 defense contractor companies. The Big Five, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon and Northrop Grumman, and some others acquired the next tier of manufacturers such as Hughes Aircraft and McDonnell Douglas. In the year to June 2020, the Big Five accounted for nearly a third of the $480 billion obligated by the Pentagon to defense contractors. Meanwhile, the defense sector spent over $2.4 billion lobbying Congress since 2001. These defense contractors make direct campaign contributions to most congressional members. 1. Lockheed Martin. Total sales, $46.5 billion. Gross profit, $2.7 billion. 2. Boeing. Total sales, $68.7 billion. Gross profit, $4 billion. 3. BAE. Total sales, $30.7 billion. Gross profit, $2.3 billion. 4. General Dynamics. Total sales, $32.7 billion. Gross profit, $2.5 billion. 5. Northrop Grumman. Total sales, $26.4 billion. Gross profit, $2.1 billion.
I'd like to welcome my next guest to the program, Dr. Ranjit Brar.
Ranjit Brar. Dr. Brar is a political analyst, a journalist, and a public speaker. He has been actively involved in the British anti-war movement for 30 years. Brar regularly contributes to the workers' journals Proletarian and Laocoon. He is the author of Britain's Road to Socialism.
Well, thanks so much for joining me. Do you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq prior to the September 11th attacks?
Well, I think the clearest indication that there was a pre-existing plan to attack Iraq prior to September 11th, 2001 was, of course, the fact that the original invasion of Iraq had taken place in 1990-1991 under George H. Bush. At that time, whilst Saddam Hussein was much weakened and Iraq was much weakened, and the oil for food program of quite draconian sanctions was installed upon Iraq. And famously, Madeleine Albright, of course, at that time said it was worth the pain inflicted on the Iraqi people, in particular the 500,000 children who died of malnutrition and related diseases due to those sanctions. Madeleine Albright quite clearly said, yes, it was worth it. So there was obviously a pre-existing plan to invade Iraq. In terms of the 2003 invasion, there had been a plan. General Wesley Clark gave an interview in which he quite clearly said that around the 2001 attacks, when he was visiting Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz in the Pentagon, they'd clearly intimated him a plan not only to attack Iraq, but in fact a list of seven other countries in the immediate future.
Well, do you think the attacks were needed to use as justification for invading these countries?
In terms of whether 9/11, September 11, the attacks on the Twin Towers, Pentagon, and White House, because let's not forget it was all three sites that were initially attacked, were a useful justification. They were certainly used as a useful justification. Were they necessary to justify those acts of aggression by the United States? Personally, whilst they were clearly, they pitched their media to a level of hysteria and hyperbole not seen before or since, and pivoted towards the war on terror as justification for all of their aggressive operations abroad. In fact, that was nothing new in a sense, and really the Monroe Doctrine since 1847 had declared, U.S. a right to dominate the Western Hemisphere, the Americas, as their own territorial sphere of interest, as their own colony, their de facto colony, their zone to exploit. It was in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, really, that the United States and Bush, after Reagan, had really said there would be a new world order. This was the era in which America would be a world policeman, in which they would really come to now dominate the globe. And that unipolar moment, as we can call it, is a historical moment, has been continuing to this day. So was September 11th used by the United States establishment? Absolutely. Did they need that to justify their aggressive and hostile actions? Well, if you look at the American history, there have been perhaps 4 or 5 years in the total history of America when they've not been at war with one or another country. It's a country founded on genocide, essentially, and an empire founded upon ongoing bloodshed. There's not really been a single day's peace since the Second World War. America has been continual at war with other nations around the globe. So my personal feeling is that while they used it to their own advantage, they spun the media into a state of frenzy, they would have done exactly the same had September the 11th not occurred.
Who benefited from the war on Iraq?
That's a very good question. So the precise figures of the profits made by the US state, and in particular US companies, are hard to calculate. They will certainly run into hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars, and that would be the direct looting of Iraq's oil, which was the fundamental reason for going into Saddam Hussein, of course, was threatening to flout US diktat, no longer comply with producing the necessary quantities of oil at the necessary prices in the interests of the US, and rather was going to cooperate with OPEC. So they lost control of Saddam Hussein, and this very important Iraq has perhaps 10 to 15% of the world's proven oil reserves, as has other important countries, of course, including Iran and Kuwait, Saudi in the region. What were the other things they benefited from? So the war itself, the incredible military expenditure. US has a military budget of $850 billion per annum on military, more than enough to solve the vast majority of the world's problems in healthcare, in nutrition, and in housing. But of course, that money is not dedicated to solving those problems, but to reinforcing America's exploitation of the world and their exploitative position. But Lockheed Martin, Boeing, so many US defense contractors and companies made literally a killing, but absolute fortune in monetary terms from the war itself and from the sales of weapons to the American government, to the British government, to the coalition of the willing, so-called, and to other nations based on their testing of weapons on an army which, relatively speaking, you know, was absolutely unable to defend itself against this huge onslaught of the world's largest industrial powers under the NATO umbrella. In addition to that, of course, there were huge contracts for reconstruction and occupation of Iraq over an extended period of time. And given the size of the bases and contractors who still operate in Iraq, you can see that those profits and loot are ongoing. And of course, ultimately, all of the money to pay for all of those operations came, in addition to an extent from the American taxpayer, overwhelmingly from loot extracted from the Iraq. And that includes, incidentally, the confiscation of the gold bullion reserves of the central bank. So however you look at it, you know, this was an absolute, not even a neo-colonial, but a classical colonial operation of plunder, which meant that Iraq went from being one of the most prosperous countries on earth, more prosperous than most southern European nations, more prosperous than Spain, arguably more prosperous than Italy, certainly more prosperous than Greece, to being one of the poorest countries on earth, where chaos still rules. And this is precisely, of course, the intended desire, because while that chaos rules, while the Iraqi people can't demand the repatriation of their oil wealth, that looting continues.
Can you explain the concept of war on terror and how it served those who instigated this concept?
The concept of the war on terror was a very useful device to find a new enemy to justify the reason for not only ongoing military expenditure, ongoing NATO alliance, but in fact its constant expansion. As we've seen, NATO has been expanding right up towards the borders of Russia and China. So global domination, in fact, was the name of the game. But that was portrayed, you know, as America was a victim, America was the great upholder of democracy, America would be the world's policeman. It was America's mission to go and impose, you know, democracy, the free market, and institutions of NATO, EU, and other military alliances, essentially that served their own military and economic machine. So this essentially was making the world safe for the penetration of American capital. But, you know, war after war after war was fought against people after people to stop them having independent governments that would put the interests of those nations first.
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here in Hidden Files. September 11th was indeed a tragic event, but thanks to mainstream media, what many don't realize is that the main victims of the 9/11 incident were not Americans. They were unarmed civilians. They were Iraqi families, unsuspecting of who may break into their homes. Other victims of 9/11 were women and children being terrorized in their homes, and many are still being born with signs of terror all over their bodies, with horrifying birth defects due to depleted uranium and other chemicals. Birth defects like they were killed, wounded, and uprooted, not in the thousands, but in the millions, and yet they were neither paid reparations, nor did they even receive an official apology. And more importantly, there has been no accountability for the crimes committed, as trillions of dollars have been spent to cause havoc and to line the pockets of those heavily invested in war and chaos. Well, Hidden Files will continue to bring your attention to what's going on with this war on terror that was declared 21 years ago and is still causing death and destruction around the globe. Now, that's it for me, Marzia Hashimi, and all the crew here this week on Hidden Files.
IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump is suing CNN for defamation, claiming the cable television network has harmed his reputation with false defamatory and infamatory reporting and harmed his political career. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. The website of NBC News has more on this story. Former President Donald Trump sued CNN alleging defamation on Monday, 3rd of October, accusing the news network of taking persistent actions aimed at defeating him politically. According to a lawsuit filed in the U.S. District Court for Southern Florida, Donald Trump alleged CNN has maliciously made false and defamatory statements about him. He's seeking $475 million in punitive damages, as well as compensatory damages, to be determined at trial. Beyond simply highlighting any negative information about the plaintiff and ignoring all positive information about him, CNN has sought to use its massive influence, purportedly as a trusted news source, to defame the plaintiff in the minds of its viewers and readers, for the purpose of defeating him politically. Trump lawyers Lindsay Halligan and James Trustee wrote in the 29-page complaint. CNN's campaign of dissuasion in the form of libel and slander against the plaintiff has only escalated in recent months as CNN fears the plaintiff will run for president in 2024, they added. Donald Trump hasn't said yet whether he will run for president again. Trump's lawyers alleged in the lawsuit that CNN has used both false and defamatory labels against the former president, including racist, Russian lackey, and insurrectionist. His attorneys also referred to what they said was CNN's persistent association of the plaintiff to Adolf Hitler and Nazism. According to the lawsuit, CNN refused Donald Trump's request in July to retract 34 articles and TV segments he considered defamatory, and wouldn't comply with demands that it stop referring to his false claims about the outcome of the 2020 presidential election as lies. Trump's lawyers argued that using the term big lie in relation to Donald Trump was part of a deliberate effort by CNN to propagate to its audience an association between the plaintiff and one of the most repugnant figures in modern history, namely Adolf Hitler. CBS News has also covered the same story. Former President Donald Trump is suing CNN for defamation and asking for compensatory damages in excess of $75,000 and punitive damages of $475 million, according to a lawsuit filed on Monday, 3rd of October. He is claiming that the cable news giant has harmed his reputation with false defamatory and inflammatory